Hello, hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today, I'm here with Miss Julie Bracker. Julie, how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much.
Good, good. Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, as always, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review, all the things. Really helps me out. Thanks in advance. Julie, tell us about your background and how you got to where you are today.
I could go on and on. I'll be brief. I've turned myself into a one-trick pony at this point. I have been doing Federal False Claims Act litigation and pretty much only that with a side order of some other whistleblower laws, but basically Federal False Claims Act work since 2006. My partner, Jason Marcus, and I started our firm in 2015, and we've been turning out False Claims Act cases since then.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, let's dive right in then. Talk to us about what is the False Claims Act and what are the origins of it? Because I think that's pretty fascinating in itself.
So I'm going to express opinions that are my own, and they are not legal opinions. They are not legal advice. They are strictly me chatting with my pal Jacob about how things look in this very interesting and very developing area of law. So take it all with a grain of conversational salt. And enjoy what you can glean from it, but please don't take it as any sort of advice. That's a pretty risky question. Talk about the False Claims Act, one trick pony. I can do that for, I could have a whole extra episode, but it is an interesting statute. The Federal False Claims Act, it's called Lincoln's Law. It was actually passed during the Civil War era. And its purpose was, we had some folks who were taking tremendous advantage of the federal government during war times. And they would send flour, but it had weevils in it. Supposedly, they would order horses for the troops. The troops would get the horses, and they would be nearly dead, then, you know, starved. They sent uniforms that were made of tissue instead of cloth. Just some terrible things that were happening. And some of that, there's modern versions of that that happen today that the False Claims Act can be aimed at as well. The idea was, it's very difficult to figure out who's responsible for this and get our money back. It's a very powerful law. It is for the purpose of catching people who are defrauding the government. And so the way that the statute is set up, if you steal from the government, then the government recovers treble damages, three times the damages, and you pay for the attorney's fees. The really weird part about the FCA, and this is pretty much the only place in American jurisprudence where this still exists, is a holdover from England called the quitam provision. So the quitam provision is a very long Latin phrase that the first two words of which are quitam, and it's Latin, so it's qui, not key, like quid pro quo. The quitam provision says that if you, a citizen, know of a fraud being perpetrated against the government, then you can report it, you can relate to the government what has happened, and you become a relator. When you relate what's happened, and they recover, then you can receive up to 30% of what they recover, which you think about it is nicely balanced. They're going to get treble damages. The relator can get up to a third of that, and the government is still keeping double damages. So a couple of things about that. You can't bring that action on your own. You need an attorney. You can't, because you're standing in the shoes of the federal government and saying, this is what has happened to the government. And the process for doing that is also really weird. Even lawyers who've practiced for it, this is a very peculiar little weird area of the law. The process would be, say you knew about a fraud being perpetrated against the United States or federal. So basically, someone's lying to get money from the government that they're not entitled to, or someone is lying to keep money that they're not entitled to. So that happens both ways. It's called a reverse false claim. Basically, all the same thing. In the Reagan era, there was a lot of complaints about the defense industry robbing the United States with their very expensive $7,000 hammers and so forth. The FCA made a reappearance. And in the late 1980s, there were amendments Congress put through to take away what was then called a government knowledge bar, which is the idea that if the government already knows about a fraud, you're not telling them anything it doesn't know already, so you can't recover anything as a relator. Right. Well, you know, the government is not like one person. Not like saying, well, Jacob knew. It's like saying, did someone in government know this? And that kept the government from paying out any whistleblower rewards, which prevented anybody from coming forward, because who wants to risk their career, their life, literally their life in some instances, to report these things? Who's willing to do that when there's no chance of any recovery whatsoever? You know, it's a very important part of the program that attorney's fees get paid and that the whistleblower is incentivized. After the amendments, it was certainly used in the defense industry, but then some of my colleagues looked around and said, you know what's also a contract with the federal government? Medicare, Medicaid, all of these, healthcare. And now I would say healthcare is probably close to 80, 85% of False Claims Act cases that are brought. CMS has gotten very good at the mechanics of dealing with the FCA, which I guess I should back up and tell you about a little bit. If you come to me and say, hey, my employer is miscoding, you know, every time my doctor sees a patient, he says it's a level 5 visit. And it's actually, you know, not true that it's always a level 5 visit. Some of them are 1, statistically improbable that they're all going to be 5s. But maybe what you know is that he's told you, I don't care how long I see the patient, coded as a 5. And you're worried because you're being asked to put into the billing system something that's not true. And you're afraid, hey, what if it comes back on me and he blames me? This is fraud. You know, what do I do? So you call me or one of my colleagues and hopefully someone who knows how the FCA works. That's really important. And we package up the information. We make sure that, yes, indeed, that does sound like a violation of the FCA because there are rules and regulations around Medicare particularly, you know, very complex. Mm-hmm. So we sort of kick the tires on what you think is wrong, make sure we agree that that's fraudulent, put together all the information in the way that the government can best ingest it, and then we file a case under seal. Under seal sounds very exciting, right? But what it really means is that the only people who know about that case are the government that we serve the complaint on. And remember, they're really the plaintiff. We're just standing in their shoes and relating to them what happened. Mm-hmm. So the government knows, the relator knows, and the court knows. But the defendants don't know. Which normally in a lawsuit, after you file the complaint, you've got a short period of time where you need to go and serve the complaint on the defendant. There's no service under the FCA until after the seal period expires. By statute, that's 60 days. In real life, it takes 60 days for the government to realize it has a case and needs to put people staffing it, right? Yeah. So the first thing that happens typically is the government will move for an extension of the seal. And those are usually done in months. Some districts, some judges will allow them to go ahead and take a year at the very beginning because realistically, we're looking at a 2 to 3 year seal period on a pretty fast case. It's just a complicated process because the government will assemble its team. The government will interview the relator so they can hear from the relator directly what I have packaged in this written format. And then the investigation will begin. That may include a civil investigative demand, which is like a government subpoena where they're getting documents. It may include talking with witnesses. Usually they'll start with the former employees. You know, they want to see if other people substantiate what the relator is saying. And eventually, if everything checks out, they'll get to the point where they may ask for what's called a partial lift of the shield, which means the defendant is brought into the seal. And now, you know, during that time, the defendant may be responding to CIDs or giving testimony. They may even be deposing some of the people at the company, and they may not know. They likely don't know. They know they're under investigation. But an FCA case can even be brought by the government itself. It doesn't have to be under the QUITAM statute. So they don't know if they're dealing with a whistleblower, just a government investigation, maybe just an agency investigation. They really are not sure until that partial lift. At that point, they're usually told. Sometimes they're given a copy of the complaint. Sometimes they're given a redacted copy of the complaint where we take off the whistleblower's name and information. Although in a lot of settings, I'd say most of the time, they're going to have a pretty good idea who the whistleblower was because they've raised the issue internally before they ever came out. Sometimes they've left that employment. I've had whistleblowers who were with their defendant employer the whole time for the lawsuit.
Wow.
It can go a lot of directions. So I think I've over answered that question. But that's the FCA. That's what it is. Getting money back from the government, from fraudsters, and rewarding people who are willing to report what they see going on. As the 1880s saying went, you have to sometimes set a rogue to catch a rogue. And that's important. Even if you have participated in a fraud, whether you're the very innocent person who didn't even know that if they added an 11 to the end of their code that they were robbing the government, to somebody who told the boss, hey, you know what, if I add an 11, you're going to get more money. But without understanding that it was a fraudulent act, it's always interesting to me. Benjamin Franklin is credited with a quote that there's something along the lines of, there's no evil into which good men fall more easily than fraud on the government, right? Because there are people who would never reach over and take a 20 out of my pocket. But if they got 20 from the government accidentally and they didn't know why, they'd just cash that check, right? Because the government is kind of all of us and none of us, you know, not really a person. We don't really always feel that they're on our side. You know, it's an interesting situation because I see people who really don't understand this is fraud. You know, this is fraud, just as if you pull that 20 out of my purse. Mm-hmm. And the people who are troubled by what they're experiencing and will bring that to the government's attention are my clients. They're absolutely fantastic.
A few things came to my mind as you were speaking. one of which is, of course, the risks from a whistleblower's standpoint, because we always hear about their incentives and things like that. But can you talk to us about the risks that, you know, and so maybe even some of the real bad situations that have happened in the past?
You know, I tell my clients, here's the best case scenario, that the case is under seal. The client starts looking for another job. They find another job before the defendant knows that they're a target of the government, or at least before they blame my client. So they're not there to blackball them. But oftentimes what happens is that the client is already at such loggerheads with the defendant before they ever even get to me. A lot of times they've been fired already. And there is a provision under the FCA for retaliation where in that claim, the claim for the government belongs to the government and you don't get to decide what they do with it. The claim for retaliation belongs to my client. We can pursue that independently, even if the government decides not to go after the defendant for the fraudulent or the allegedly fraudulent conduct. But yeah, the risk can be something to take seriously. You know, it's frankly the reason why we have the incentive, the strong incentives that we do for people to come forward, because it may just be money. But we're going to talk about the cyber fraud initiative here in a bit. And we're talking about state secrets. We're talking about threat actors who are interested in undermining our country. We're talking about national security. And we can't have those people who know that's going on afraid to come forward. That's why we have the whole system built in to take care of them, from having their attorney, who's going to be paid by the bad guy, to making sure that they can have their own cause of action if they're retaliated against. What I will see happen often is a client who's been terminated from their position that they're reporting fraud on, then having trouble getting that next job because of whispers and innuendos that you can't prove. That's a really hard case to prove. I represented Dr. David Felton in the versus Beaumont, so it's USXREL Beaumont hospitals in Detroit. And we wound up going all the way to the Supreme Court on the question of whether a relator can be blackballed, whether blackballing is covered by the retaliation statute. And thankfully, at least in the Sixth Circuit, it's covered. We do have a cause of action. If we can prove that blackballing occurred, we can get some restitution for that. You would think that would be pretty straightforward. It was a long battle up and down to the Sixth Circuit and into the Supreme Court. The government's decision is its intervention decision. So we file the case as relators, and the government can intervene and take over the case. When they do that, that means they're going to be first chair, lead attorney on the case, and I'll be second chair. So we'll still be helping, but the government will be in charge. If that happens, then the relator's share at the end of the day will be between 15 and 25%. 25% is reserved for those situations where we go to trial and the relator has to testify. Maybe they've worn a wire at some point during the investigation. You know, it's a pretty extreme examples. I think the last time I looked, the average recovery in an intervening case somewhere between 17, 18%, something like that. But often defendants would rather settle and have it announced as a settlement rather than go through a trial having all the evidence trotted out about how naughty they've been, because the government is pretty careful about going to trial when they don't feel certain that they're going to win. Now, the other way it can go, and this is probably somewhere between 75 and 85% of the time, and that depends on who you ask, the government declines the case. And if they decline, then you have the choice as relator. You can continue to go forward. You can litigate it. You can continue to go forward and settle it. It is not a reflection. The government decision is, and there's government statements about this given in many declined cases that go to trial. Few cases go to trial. Fewer still are in a declined posture when they do. But when they do, we've had some very, as a relator's bar, we've had some very big successes, because the government sometimes declines because of risk. Sometimes declines because of resources. Sometimes declines because they've already sort of made their statement about how this particular area of the law should work, and they're diverting the resources somewhere else. It can be policy considerations. There can be any number of factors that play into it. What it doesn't mean is that it's a bad case. As a relator's counsel, when the government is making that decision, you want to get every bit of information you can on why they're declining. Because obviously, I only get paid if I win. I don't want to pursue a bad case. If the reason they're declining is it's a bad case, I'd rather be told, know it early, and see if we need to just focus on retaliation, what we need to do in the best interest of our client. Where if the government, and they sometimes do say, we're not going forward on this one, we think there's a case here, but the dollars, you know, we've got all the cases to pick from, and the amount of recovery we're going to get from this one we don't think will warrant the amount of resources put into it, but we would love it if you go forward with this case. Then we have to evaluate, first of all, our client. Are you in for a long haul litigation? By now you've been doing this for 3 to 5 years. You know, are you in it for another 3 to 5 years with risk and with your name out there in the open instead of under seal? We have to think about resources that we would put into it as a firm. But, you know, there are also times where the government says, we've looked into this and the facts just aren't there to support it. I had one case quite memorably where the relator was one of those biller coders who had put in information into the system. And 100%, I know it, I believe her that it was happening, but someone up the chain was fixing it. So when you got into looking at what actually was billed, it was billed properly. It's kind of a funny story how all that was happening. But, you know, at that point, we dismissed the case voluntarily while it's still under seal. The case may or may not be unsealed after that. You have to be prepared as a False Claims Act plaintiff that you likely, as a relator, that is, that you probably will have your name somewhere in the court files at some point. So, but there's obviously a big difference between having your case written up about in the New York Times versus having your case quietly come out from under seal in a dismissed posture because nobody cares. So it's
right,
doesn't hit the internet, so to speak.
Well, that's really fascinating. And also bring up another point. I was thinking about the numbers, right, of complaints that might be under seal. Is there any government resource that we can look at to see, for example, like, do they have stats on this available or anything like that?
Every year, the government reports on how much it recovered through the FCA, how much of that was brought by relators, and it breaks it down by industry. It's pretty interesting to look at how much is quitam versus not quitam in the different industries and different years. It's very interesting.
Well, that's a great segue into the DOJ's Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. Talk to us about that and what that is.
It's fun to say, right? We'll trip you on the tongue. We call it the CCFI, Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. So if you break that down, civil as opposed to criminal, right? The Department of Justice is divided into two sides of the house, the criminal side and the civil side. And it's important to note that because I noticed in the LinkedIn conversations, now that the cyber people are taking a look at the FCA world, that there's some confusion over that. Like, this is not a throw you in jail part of the statute, although there are criminal penalties that can be associated with the FCA. This is the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. Cyber fraud, you know more about than I do. And the initiative means the Department of Justice is really interested in this right now. It tells us as Relators Council, be on the lookout, right? That below. This is the kind of case we want to see. And they were very candid when they announced it. I think it's October 2020. But they basically said, look, we know that people are not taking their cyber obligation seriously. Against that background, let's say that, you know, we have CMMC being developed, but we're not there yet. Since January 2018, particularly if you're a defense contractor, you've been under an obligation through the federal acquisition regulations, the defense federal acquisition regulations, the FARs and DFARs, we love our acronyms in government, have obligated you to follow the NIST standards. And if they're ingesting or creating CUI, then they need to be in compliance with these standards. And what the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative comes along about 2.5 years later and says, we don't think you're doing it, right? All this self-attestation, we're not so sure that you're really doing it. And we're going to incentivize people to report, which is a great thing because as that has opened up, I have heard from so many people who are in such straits feeling concerned that they know that, you know, state secrets are not protected, that our intellectual property is out in the clear and that there's no appropriate defense being placed around it. And they've raised it internally and they've fought battles internally and they're just not able to get it a proper amount of attention and funding put on it to get it fixed. Behold, the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. And that gives you a chance to come to a Relators Council and let the government know what's going on. When they announced the initiative, they did it in what I call three flavors of cyber fraud initiative cases. And these are not exclusive, but these are the kind of things that we're looking for. So the first would be knowing failure to comply with cybersecurity regulations or standards, and you're not in compliance. And the government is saying, bring us those cases. And remind me to tell you about materiality in a minute, because that's where the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative kind of stepped in. But we got knowing failure to comply with cybersecurity standards, knowing misrepresentation of security controls and practices. So there's where you're putting in, I think our SPURS score is 102, and maybe it's not. Maybe it's actually -4. Maybe it's 75. It's not quite that bad. But when you knowingly input your SPUR score wrong, you're making a false representation to the federal government about your cybersecurity practices and controls. And that's going to fall under the Federal False Claims Act.
And I have a question about that, because there are a lot of companies who maybe just, they think they did a good job and they submit a score that's inaccurate. Is that what this is focused on? Or is it the people who are like, we don't care. We're just submitting a 110, you know, whatever.
So it's a great question. And the answer is somewhere in between. This is a fraud statute. It's a fraud, waste, and abuse. The word knowingly is there, right? Knowing misrepresentation. Mm-hmm. So let's take one instance where you, in 2018, 2019, you put in your SPUR score and you had Bob the IT guy review your system. Mm-hmm. And he looked at it and said, looks good to me. And thus was born your SPUR score. You put it in the system and you move on down the road. Well, sometime between then and 2024, you ought to have become aware of the fact that this is a pretty specialized area. This is not something that necessarily every IT guy is going to understand the meaning of the NIST controls. Mm-hmm. And there's many, many opportunities for educating yourself, your company. And somewhere along the line, most companies by this point have brought in an actual cybersecurity person, mm-hmm. right? So enter cybersecurity Bob. And he looks and goes, holy moly, kid, that's not at all as high as you thought it was. That's not what this means. You know, helps them understand and audit their own system. And when that happens, it's now knowing. Now you know that it's not what you thought it was. So you've got some choices there. You can go in and change it, which is what I think is probably what you ought to do, is update that score and put in your plan of action and correction and poem. I know it's a poem and I get all the little words mixed up, but you put your poem in and that's how you let the government know we're on it. And that's the open and honest way to communicate, right? As opposed to, hey, we don't have to certify again for another 3 years. So let's score that's out there as a knowing misrepresentation and let's just try to fix it before the 3 years are up. And then what I'm seeing in a lot of what I'm hearing from relators and potential relators is the business end, operations end says, yeah, we'll deal with that before the next certification period. And then they don't put the resources on it. And that sort of 3 years vanishes in a flash like it does in my life. And now you've got to recertify. Now you're not where you said you are and you're doing another certification. So I guess the law answer is the word knowingly can mean actual knowledge. Like I knew that it was wrong and I did it anyway. Yeah. It can also mean all the way over to reckless disregard or deliberate ignorance. So you can't put your fingers in your ears, your head in the sand. Nah. I hear nothing. Right. I know nothing. And consider that, well, I didn't know.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm just thinking about a scenario where you have Bob, the IT guy, right? And he doesn't know NIST. And he's saying, I need training on this. Yeah. And you just say, nah, just do it.
Do the best you can, Bob.
Huh? Yeah, that's definitely a trouble area. Talk to us about an external provider like an MSP, because I think a lot of small businesses rely on MSPs. Is there a difference between relying on an internal employee or relying on an external entity like a MSP to give you your cybersecurity compliance?
Yes, there is a difference. There's a big difference. In the employee situation, you're controlling, as you noted, his training, his access, his funding, his job duties. You know, this is not the kind of scheme for a big campus where Bob the IT guy is going to be able to run the campus, do all the updates that are required, do the cybersecurity, manage the NIST obligations. You know, you're going to need more people than that, depending on the size of the campus, obviously. Mm-hmm. But if you can contract that out, then someone else is legally on the hook for taking care of it. Now, they may be subject to a suit because they're not doing what they're promising their customers. Mm-hmm. Often their customers could even include the federal government, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a really good and nuanced question. There is a provision under the False Claims Act. It's actually to submit a false claim or cause to be submitted a false claim. Mm-hmm. So if I'm the doctor lying on the billing, but I myself never submit a claim to the government, then the people that are actually submitting it are not necessarily in trouble if all their job is to put in what you hand me and hit go to the government. Mm-hmm. They're not on the hook for submitting a false claim because they didn't know it was a false claim. But the doctor is because he caused them to submit the false claim. So it'd be kind of the same thing. If you had a contract for someone to provide your cybersecurity and they weren't doing what they said they were doing, then you have a knowing cause to be submitted false information coming from the contracted company. But if it's Bob, your IT guy, you're the one in control of Bob. And if Bob's not doing his job, presumably you need to replace him with Tom, the IT guy, or right. Susie, the IT gal, and get that addressed.
Right. But on the other hand, if you are contracting to an MSP, but they're not necessarily responsible for providing your NIST compliance services, getting you that high SPRS score, but you're just relying on them because you don't want to look into it, then you could be liable. Is that right?
If I understood the question, yes. So if you're not paying attention to what you're buying, or you are over relying on the services being provided without looking into what they're promising that they do, then yes, you could be on the hook for that. You can't just say, well, I use Microsoft. I'm good. That's not okay.
You
have to be responsible for it. You can delegate it. You can pay someone to do it, just like you can pay Bob to do it, but you're responsible for it.
Yes, yes. Makes sense. Now, we just talked about knowing misrepresentation of security controls and practices. There's a third one. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that is the knowing failure to report suspected cyber incidents. That's the one that I think everybody jumps to. And I think the reason people jump to that is because it seems like if there's not been an incident or a breach, I call it a breach because I'm a plaintiff's lawyer, but if there's not been one, then what's the damage, right? And that, I think, underlines why there's a civil cyber fraud initiative. We need to know about it before there's a breach. We want people to correct it. We want to incentivize people to correct these gaps in cybersecurity before the horse is out the barn door. And so this is, if your horse has gone through the barn door, you need to report it to the government, but you know, for all kinds of reasons. They need to know so that they can keep up with who the threat actors are, what kind of schemes are being used. There's a limited amount the FBI can do when it doesn't have data, right? Mm-hmm. And so getting that data in the hands of the FBI is critical. At the same time, if, you know, my intellectual property has been stolen, I'd kind of like to know that. You know, it's a little bit like confessing to your parents, you know, yes, that was my hand in the cookie jar, but it's just going to get worse if you don't report it, right? And so I have not personally brought yet a cyber incident case. And it's not to say I wouldn't. One of the questions that I have about it is, remember, always knowing failure to report suspected incidents. So when does it rise to the level of suspected? How much do you have to believe it's likely? What kind of incident are we talking about? I mean, those are some very squishy terms. Mm-hmm. And so I find it much less squishy to say you misrepresented your controls than I do to say you should have reported this suspected incident. That doesn't mean I won't take that case with the right case because, you know, the squishy part's in the middle. There's cases where you clearly should have reported. There are cases where I cannot imagine that anybody would be upset you didn't report. But then there's a lot of territory in between those two.
Interesting. You mentioned materiality before.
That really goes to materiality. And I usually say that when I say why there is a civil cyber fraud initiative. If you had come to me as Bob the IT guy, you know, in 2018, and said, my company signed on the dotted line and put this number in their SPR score, and they are not compliant with NIST, I would have been very hesitant to bring that case. Because one of the things that you have to prove under a False Claims Act scenario is that, okay, they knew they were lying, they lied, and that the lie mattered. And that's what materiality is. But it could be that, you know, the contract says, you're going to build them from the ground up. You'll have all the subcontractors under you doing everything. And by the way, you're only going to use American-made products, okay? Or you're going to pay a certain level of wage because this is a federal contract. So the level of wage case is a Davis-Bacon Act case. Davis-Bacon Act says how much you got to pay your hourly workers. And it's a very, you think it'd be easy, but it's a very complicated table that changes a lot and depends on whether you're classified as, you know, a master electrician or different levels. Same with use only American products. That all of those are real cases and we brought them, but they're very tricky because the government contracted for buildings. If they had known that you really were not paying Davis-Bacon wages, would they have given you the contract? And the answer is, well, how do we quantify the damage for that? You know, obviously they wanted they didn't just want a building built because they spend for policy reasons. Mm-hmm. So they wanted buildings built, and they wanted those wages to go out to the right people. And they wanted you to support our domestic industry by buying American products. And when you don't do some of that, then you have to start asking a question. Well, okay, did they run to the hardware store because they were out of nails and bought some nails at Home Depot that turns out were from China? So one box of nails is probably not material, right? Mm-hmm. If you sourced all your steel from some place where you shouldn't be sourcing steel, that's a different level of problem. We're still going to have to figure out the damages. And there's a lot of ways that we look at damages under procurement contracts. And, you know, frankly, these cases have not yet made it through the cycle far enough to have that answered by courts. You're going to have arguments on all sides. And the courts typically look at how much the utility of the thing you did contract for was affected. And, you know, I would say, and I'm a relator's counsel, like if I'm paying you to develop intellectual property for me, and you're making it available to the wide world because you won't put up your proper cyber controls, mm-hmm. I'm not getting any value for my money, mm-hmm. right? Another suggestion I've made in these cases, we don't know where it's going to go yet, but what about remediation? If you are, I'm going to call you mega company, and you've got deep pockets, and you've been doing everything wrong because you don't want to spend money, you want to have profits, and you have not complied with NIST, and let's say there's not even been an incident yet, you know, what you've avoided paying to come up to speed might be the measure of the damages. This is just Julie talking. So this is not the government or case law, but that's one way to quantify what you took away from us. I think it's an important point too. The government wants to make sure that companies who do the right thing are not penalized. If you have three companies and two of them are doing the spend they need to do to make sure they're cyber compliant and company C does not, it's at a, you know, competitive advantage in not having to spend that money and still getting all the same benefits. That's sort of a restitution kind of model, a remediation model. But of course, what you would do, remember it's a treble damages statute, is you would say, it's going to cost you $1 million, just to use easy math because lawyers are bad at math, $1 million to get compliant. And you're going to pay the U.S. $2 million in damages under the False Claims Act. And we want you to take that other million and fix it, right? Okay. That's another way to maybe think about it. I don't know what courts will say. I'm not sure what position the U.S. will take. It's going to be a lot more nuanced. Like mm-hmm. if you are a company whose sole reason for existence is cybersecurity mm-hmm. and you're not doing it, it's pretty darn material to the contract. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to argue that it's not, even in the pre-cyber fraud initiative days. If you are a company who builds buildings and you're not compliant, you never actually ingested CUI, but you had that type of contract for whatever reason, maybe that factually that's not going to be looked at the same way for damages purposes, mm-hmm. maybe. But yeah. There's so many factors that'll go into that decision. It's really impossible to say right now.
Now, there's been a few different complaints that have been unsealed recently in higher education. And one of those you're involved with directly, the Georgia Tech False Claims Act complaint. Can you talk to us about that and summarize what that's about?
I sure can. Now, I'll just say there are two out from under seal. So what we've had so far, we had the Aerojet Rocketdyne case that settled at $9 million 2 days into trial. And the government did not intervene in that case. It was filed in 2018 before the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. It settled in 2021, I believe, after the initiative had been announced. And the U.S. did kind of come in and settle that after the trial had already begun. So we don't really know how the damages were reached. Mm-hmm. Kind of opaque. That was the first. And they call that the first, even though it wasn't brought under the initiative. Then we've had, I think, the community health services, which was two different relators bringing two cases that were consolidated that the U.S. settled. And then we've had the Jelly Bean case, which was a case of like children's health, I believe, and they were not taking proper care of personal information, you know, HIPAA violation type case. We had Verizon, who self-disclosed that they had an issue. And they did get cooperation credit for that. You only pay double damages if you self-report. There's a big incentive there to self-report. So Verizon has settled and is considered under the act. The two sort of pending out there in the clear are both mine, and they're both coincidentally, although this is not the only kind of case I've brought, they are both, as you said, public research institutions. And there's a whole other set of policy considerations in play when you're talking about public universities and you know research centers that are centered there. The one that you referenced is the Georgia Tech case, which is here in my own Atlanta. Actually, my husband's a Georgia Tech graduate, spent many, many, many times in the Ridge Building there for Georgia Tech. So it was brought in July of 2022. And it's two folks who were inside Georgia Tech, obviously relators. And the allegations are, it's unsealed, you can see the complaint, that kind of exactly what I just described as being a very common fact pattern. There was a problem in one lab. They went in to look at that lab and realized what they had suspected, which is the campus was not consistently following the standards. Research institutions often have, how do you scope out that campus, right? Yeah. Is it for each lab? Is it for the whole campus? And because if you're a company, you know your campus. When you have different principal investigators who've always operated kind of independently, you need a governing organization to make sure that they're all complying with the NIST allegations. Whereas, you know, I think that sort of balkanization of campuses, I don't know what you have when you have that kind of amalgamation of people and different people signing the attestations and then the ones who are setting the systems up. So it really puts you in a precarious position. So those relators did their best to try to fix it internally. We're not able to do that. Thankfully, they found our firm, they found me, and we drafted that complaint. And as part of that, I started to really understand the NIST standards, which I'd never had to delve into before. So I turned that into a blog post and said, hey, this is a thing now, Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. And once I got that blog post posted, that's how Matt Decker found me, who's the relator in Decker versus Penn State. So Matt's case was filed in October of 2022. So between July and October, both of those cases were filed. And then because judges are fickle beasts, Matt's case actually was unsealed before the Georgia Tech matter. They had not even a year before the judge decided, no more extensions. You need to decide if you're intervening or not. And that's not a trivial decision, especially in a new area of law like the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. We're trying to create a new area of law where we're trying to resolve things like I just talked to you about damages. Like, we don't know how any of that works yet. So we're doing a lot of first level looking at how this will go live in the field. And they were not prepared to make a decision. So they filed what we call a demi declination, which is they say, you told us we have to decide, but we can't decide yet. And so that's not a declination, but the court won't let them just sit there. So the court says, well, if you didn't intervene, then you declined. And what we all agreed to do was to accept magistrate jurisdiction and ask the magistrate for a stay for the purpose of allowing the United States to finish its investigation. So okay, that's where we are. That 180-day stay in Decker will run out, I think, early May. And then we may be asking for another extension of the stay. They may be making an intervention decision. It could go either way. Those are just the options that are available. We don't know yet what's going to happen in Decker. Just a few weeks ago, at the end of February, the Georgia Tech case, which had been around for, what, 3 months longer, but remained under seal this entire time, the U.S. did intervene in. They have 4 months to draft what's called their complaint in intervention, which is taking my complaint and saying what pieces are going forward. I, for example, named as a defendant the Georgia Tech Research Corporation, GTRC. GTRC and GTRI are not public entities in the way that the Georgia Institute of Technology is. I also named Georgia Institute of Technology. So they're going to decide who they're going forward against. They could drop a defendant. They could add more defendants. They're going to decide which claims they're going forward on. You know, I said the whole campus is defective, or I'm using the word campus wrong there, I guess, in the college sense. I said this whole place is messed up. They could do some smaller version of that. And again, those are just options that are on the table. But we'll see when their complaint and intervention comes out exactly what they're targeting and going forward with.
Very interesting. So DOJ involvement in the Georgia Tech matter. And then when Penn State, they're deciding, essentially.
They're deciding. They're still in the deciding process.
Okay.
And I saw on LinkedIn a lot of people who are kind of confused about that. There has been no statement from the government, yes or no. All they've said is, we don't know yet. That's all that's happened in Penn State. And the only reason that they're saying that in the clear and not under seal is because that particular judge in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania decided it was an up seal for you. Out from under seal, you go. So we're now in the magistrate court doing what would normally be happening under seal in the district court.
Okay. Wow. Well, that gives everybody a bit of the inside scoop then. That's very fascinating. Wow. I want to thank you so much for coming on. This has been really, really interesting. And I think a lot of people will learn from this. So thank you so much. Where can people find you?
I'm at False Claims Act, FCACounsel.com. So it's www.fcacounsel.com. I'm Julie Bracker on LinkedIn. I would love to chat with anybody if they have questions about this. This is super interesting to me, and I'm really enjoying getting to know the community here. It's very interesting. Like I said, I've been a plus one to so many of these events. It's really fun to kind of get to know people, you know, on this level, and especially when people have concerns and questions about who are you going after. And I can't tell you what the department is going to do, but I can tell you as Relators Council what we're looking at. What I'm looking for are where people should know better by now. So I'm not buying the like, gosh, I didn't know. That's not a thing anymore. It's too impossible to be in this world, in this field, and not know that you have cyber obligations to the government, right? People who know what they should be doing and they're not doing it. They just refuse to hear it. They're not trying to make it better, or they're trying to make it better and cover up while they make it better. If you're doing that, you should be worried. If you're not doing that, you should not be so worried. This is not the end of days. This is like always, we don't want people defrauding the government. Not really a change other than that we're bringing it to the cyber realm and saying that's material to us too. Cyber security is now a material part of your contract with the government.
Yes. Well, excellent, excellent. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge today. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
So fun. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.